Trade wars, we've been told, are good and easy to win. We're going to find out how true that might be come Monday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 21st day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has been a busy week. Yes, politics, as always these days. Economy and business, too, though, so we are going to dig in. Lee Gallagher's at Fortune Magazine. Rachel Abrams is with the New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey.
So, Lee, let me go to you first, and I want you to go back to Monday with me when we learned that the White House is, in fact, going to impose a bunch of new tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports, more tariffs. Supposed to go into effect on Monday. It seems a very long time ago, but it does look like these things are going to happen now on Monday. There's been no indication they won't.
It does. It does. I mean, some people are optimistic that the parties may still come to the table. I mean, there was a time when officials were supposed to meet in D.C. from Beijing with our officials, but it's unclear if that's going to happen, and certainly not by Monday. So this is going to happen. But bear in mind, there will be a delayed impact. It's not like all the register charges 10% on day one. It needs to work its way through the retail pipeline when the goods actually get to the stores and all that. But it's happening.
So, Rachel Abrams, let me ask you this, though. You've been doing a bunch of not necessarily trade-related reporting out there, and I want to get a sense from you of life outside the business and economic journalism filter bubble of, oh, my God, tariffs all the time. What is your sense of what people are thinking about economically out there?
I mean, I think that for probably for most people in the United States that don't live in New York or L.A., jobs obviously is number one. Health insurance. You know, when I go out on reporting trips, whatever it might be, and I think that a lot of journalists have this experience too. I don't think this is unique to me, but you know, you ask about anything from the Robert Mueller investigation to the trade war, and you know, people of course might say people of course are sensitive to not having their shopping list prices, and they don't want to go to the grocery store and have their prices increased. They don't want to have to spend more on holiday shopping. For many people, they have to follow a pretty strict budget anyway. But does that mean they're following the minutiae of the trade war with China and understand every move and chess move? I don't I don't really think, not in that granular level, no.
Yeah,
but, you know, those are the people who the bill for these tariffs that impact consumer goods does fall disproportionately on lower income people. And so this is basically a tax on the lower income who can least afford to pay it.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys saw it this morning. Sorry to interrupt, Lee, but Walmart said today gas grill prices are going to go up, bicycle prices are going to go up, and Christmas lights are going to go up.
of
all things. So I guess the question then, Lee, to you is, how do we in business and economic journalism get people to pay attention other than to keep talking about this stuff? And I get this is kind of,
I do think that there will be more attention paid to this. I do think you're going to see, I mean, who knows, signs in stores. I think you're going to see people doing creative discounts. You know, I think you're going to see China tariff show up in consumers' faces a little bit more than it has been so far. And then the other risk here is also that, let's say there's a manufacturer of a product that isn't impacted, let's say socks or something. This company sources from the U.S. or elsewhere and is not impacted. Well, they might raise their prices just to match their competitors' prices. So it's more than just the actual goods that are impacted by these specific tariffs. It has a broader impact.
Yeah, Rachel,
and also people don't tend to pay attention to news stories or until it starts hurting you. You know, you're going to have perhaps less, more limited attention span to anything. And I feel like what Lee said about it's going to take a while for these things to actually go through the pipeline and for prices to rise. I know that Walmart, you mentioned that Walmart announcement. But the other thing to keep in mind is these companies also got a huge windfall from the tax cuts that the GOP just recently pushed through. So I'm skeptical that all these companies I don't know about Walmart specifically, but you have to wonder, doesn't some of that balance out the increased costs from some of these trade war escalations?
Right.
I don't know.
I think for companies, I think that's why we saw the markets go up even earlier this week. You know,
well,
I think the markets think that there's a big buffer. We've got profits booming, benefits flowing from the tax bill. But that is the market. That is not the average person. Very different.
Exactly. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, Rachel Abrams at the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
Right. Have a nice weekend. Now, Wall Street today, a little bit mixed. little bit mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There have been some developments in the Brexit story, and suffice it to say, the developments are not that the two sides have patched things up and are going to work toward a smooth British exit from the European Union. EU officials said last night the current British proposal simply is not going to work. And in a speech from 10 Downing Street today, British Prime Minister Theresa May said, well, here's what she said.
No one wants a good deal more than me, but the EU should be clear. I will not overturn the result of the referendum, nor will I break up my country. We need serious engagement on resolving the two big problems in the negotiations. And we stand ready.
Also standing ready, as he always is our European Bureau Chief, Stephen Beard. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So look, Stephen, I know that I'm just a casual observer some many thousands of miles away, but it sure looks like the EU has all the leverage here.
Well, they've got the timetable, that's for sure, because we've got two phases in this negotiating pattern here. We've got the withdrawal agreement and then the future relationship between the UK and the EU. The withdrawal agreement has got to be wrapped up by November and then approved by the British and European parliaments and most of the EU member states before exit day, which is March the 29th. If it's not, the UK crashes out without a deal. And that, for many Brits, is a somewhat alarming prospect.
So how was this, the news of the last, you know, what, 24-ish hours received over there in the UK? I mean, May's got her hands full domestically.
She certainly has, yes. The great difficulty is that the country, the UK, is completely divided over Brexit, straight down the middle, and Parliament's divided too. And it's very little to see any majority in Parliament for any of the options that are on offer. So it's very difficult to know what's going to happen next. I mean, there could be a leadership challenge within the Conservative Party to May. There could be a general election. There could be a second referendum.
Well, yeah, but didn't May say we're not doing that again? But I guess if there's a change of leadership, maybe, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it is, I mean, as we've been saying over the months, it is, you've heard of messy divorces. This is the messiest in history, and every day it gets messier. However, hardened observers of the European scene may detect a pattern here, Kai. You remember the Eurozone debt crisis?
Yes, I do.
A snail pace crisis that dragged on for several years, erupting occasionally into sort of major emergencies and then subsiding again. We could be in for something a bit similar this time, with lots of fudging, lots of deadlines coming and then whistling past.
Lots of can kicking down the road.
Absolutely, the old can kicking. We could see potentially this crisis dragging on, not for just a few more months, but for a few more years.
Stephen Beard in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
Back home, there is news from medicine today, the pharmaceutical side of the healthcare industry. Drugs, as you know, are expensive to develop, and drug companies, of course, want a return on that investment, which the easiest way to get is in part by encouraging doctors to prescribe those medicines and patients to stay on them. Outright payoffs are, of course, a no-no, but indirect benefits are a somewhat murkier area. And this week, the California Insurance Commissioner sued AbbVie, the maker of Humira, a top-selling arthritis drug, over alleged kickbacks. And the Wall Street Journal reports that several other companies are under similar investigation. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Let's start with the law. Doling out cash or gifts to induce doctors to prescribe specific drugs, a federal statute now bans drug companies from doing that.
They used to send doctors on cruises, and they send them to Hawaii golfing, and so we've kind of moved away from that.
But Lisa Gill at Consumer Reports says drug companies have gotten creative. They help cover prescription drug copays and send nurses on home visits, pushing drug sales and helping patients.
It would be great if nurses could be sent to everybody's house. A drug assistance program can be the lifeline, and it can be the difference between getting a medication and not.
Drug companies also have new incentives for doctors, and that could be more problematic, says Rice University's Vivian Ho. For instance, providing reimbursement support services to help medical offices navigate the health insurance system.
Sending staff to fill out the paperwork for reimbursement, that's an inducement to increase the amount of usage of their drugs.
Which she says could be illegal if it involves a government health program. Genevieve Cantor teaches medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. She says doctors should disclose any incentives drug companies are offering. It may seem like they're saving patients money, but
there may be other medications that may be better for them than the medications that they're getting the subsidies for.
She says even if patients do save money, pushing expensive incentivized drugs can raise costs throughout the healthcare system. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The electric scooter company Bird turned one this week, and if they don't have them where you live, Bird or its competitor Lime, they are pretty cool slash terrible, depending on your point of view. You download an app, find a scooter wherever it might have been left by the last person who used it, you scan the barcode, and off you go. Trust me, in some parts of Southern California, they are everywhere. Anyway, this week, California Governor Jerry Brown signed a law that makes it optional for adults to wear helmets when they ride, a very big win for the e-scooter lobby, as Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
In this uncertain time, with an increasingly divided nation, little is more polarizing than the electric scooter. I mean, you love them or you hate them.
For some people, they're blight. They're strewn around. They're everywhere. They're in walkways.
Scott Cummings teaches law at UCLA. He says it's easy to see why some cities have banned them, while others are more welcoming.
The business model of these companies is to put their product out in the market, whether it's legal or not, to try to generate demand, and then to force local governments to adapt law in their favor.
That approach is working in Santa Monica, at least, where a scooter pilot program has been launched after companies unleashed their fleets. But the rules aren't always clear, says Marlon Bornett. He teaches urban planning at the University of Southern California.
You can't have a situation where a person picks up a scooter, maybe on Venice Beach, and maybe they're not required to wear a helmet, and they ride into Santa Monica,
where they might get a ticket. Pushing for a state law to okay riding without a helmet was important for companies like Bird, Lime, and Scoot.
If we want to welcome this technology, and I think there's reasons why we want to, we need some consistency. And this may indeed be an area where state regulation is important.
Meanwhile, the push for e-scooters keeps growing. They're already rolling on the streets of Atlanta, Boston, and Chicago. And now, legislation has been introduced in the New York City Council to legalize the ride there. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Got to come out of that piece with this update. Two scooter riders, one in Dallas and one in Washington, D.C., have been killed in scooter accidents the past 48 hours. Coming up,
it's kind of like the race to the moon.
The next big Sino-American bone of contention. And hey, it's not even about trade. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On this Friday, the Dow up 86 points, 0.3%, 26,743. NASDAQ down 41 points, 0.5%, 79.86. S&P 500 dropped a single point, 29.29. For the week, the Dow picked up 2.25%. The NASDAQ declined 0.3%. S&P 500 found 0.8%. And let's remember there were record highs this week on the Dow and the S&P. Duke Energy had to shut down a North Carolina gas plant because of flooding in the aftermath of Hurricane Florence. Duke shares down 1%. Computer chipmaker Micron says tariffs are going to hurt its profits. Micron shares down 2.8%. Advanced Micro Devices, AMD, declined 0.5%. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note finished at 3.06%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
And we want you to listen to a podcast that we do called Make Me Smart. Every week, we talk about big issues in tech and the economy, culture, too.
For example, this week, we're getting deep on virtual reality. Kind of upsettingly deep, actually, because it could mean some next level data collection about your body.
What can you learn about somebody from their body language that the VR systems automatically track? And then also, can you build models that will predict someone's behavior based on how they're moving their bodies?
So check us out on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. Over the past couple of months, you've been hearing Divide a Decade, our year-long project covering the Great Recession and how it continues to affect our lives. As a nonprofit news organization, we believe this kind of in-depth reporting helps make people smarter about the economic forces that affect us every single day. If you agree, please go to marketplace.org to become a Marketplace investor and keep reliable, independent journalism going strong. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. If you do a search for the word leather on the list of 5,000 or so Chinese products that are scheduled to be hit with a 10% tariff on Monday, as I was talking to Lee and Rachel about, you will get 142 hits. And if you import leather raw goods from China to make your finished products here, that's about 142 more hits than you'd like, because it's going to make your cost of goods sold go up, which means you're going to have to eat those higher costs or pass them on to your customer. But there is an exception to prove every rule, and our exception today is Michael Korchmar. He runs the leather specialty company in Naples, Florida, and he testified in favor of the new set of tariffs to the U.S. Trade Representative last month. So we got him on the phone to talk about how the new changes in American trade policy are going to help him. Mr. Korchmar, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you, Guy.
Give me the quick skinny on your company. What do you make? What do you do?
We manufacture all types of bags, luggage, leather goods, things of that sort. It's a fourth generation, 101-year-old company that still produces in the United States of America.
And to hear tell from the testimony you gave to the United States Trade Representative and the letter you wrote, you are getting killed by Chinese competition.
Well, that's no exaggeration. I started my career in 1977, and we were the largest producer of leather business cases in the world. By 1982, China had knocked off our styles and undercut our pricing to the point where we'd lost 30% to 40% of our volume. And in order to survive, I actually went to China and started operating a business there.
Did you really? How'd that go?
I was making a fortune and felt dirty.
Huh.
I should say we also operate a plant in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. After my stint in China in the 80s, in order to compete and survive, we started a plant in the DR, the oldest democracy in the Caribbean, a country that tends to support our values a bit more than China, and struggled for many years to make it against China down there, but came out on the good side of it. And that's allowed us to continue our U.S. operation as well. And now it's growing. Both are growing by leaps and bounds, first because of the threat of these tariffs, and now, my goodness, it looks like they're really happening. So we're tightening our seatbelts and just trying to grow as fast as we can.
You're being undercut, I assume, by these Chinese imports by some significant degree, right?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Back in the 80s and 90s, we couldn't win a job. If we would do experiments and we'd quote 10% below material cost, and China would always bid lower.
So let's think about this from the consumer's perspective here for a second, sir. So American consumers, if they want to buy leather goods of the type that you make, they can either pay more for what you make and support an American business, or they can pay more for a now tariffed Chinese import and support a Chinese business. Is that your basic take, that consumers got to pay for what's right?
No, it's not that simple, really. I mean, they don't need to pay more, or certainly not much more, if it's being made by us in the Dominican Republic. And the interesting thing about that, Guy, is that the materials we use when we produce in the Dominican Republic are U.S. materials made by U.S. workers. So if you keep it on, even if you keep it on this side of the world, you're supporting U.S. manufacturing.
Last thing, sir, and I'll let you go. You say you're buckled in, trying to grow as fast as you can. How long do you think this trade war goes?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I don't know. I don't know. I don't think it's a war. I think it's business. And the Chinese understand it. They've been cleaning our clocks for 40 years and loving every minute of it. And all they see now is that we've finally awakened and are doing to them what they've been doing to us. It's not a war. It's just business.
Michael Kortchmar, CEO of the leather specialty company, Pro Tariffs, Mr. Kortchmar is. Thanks for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate being included.
We're going to do a little tech here, actually tech nomenclature and then some tech practical application. 4G is the current standard for wireless technologies, fourth generation, hence 4G. It's what makes those apps you rely on every day possible, the speed of it. The next generation, the fifth, will be called, cleverly, 5G. And it's not going to be just an incremental bump in performance either. The tech industry figures 5G is going to be a game changer for everything from the Internet of Things to self-driving cars and more. And I know what you're thinking here, right? Business opportunity. And it is. Jobs, revenue, building industries of tomorrow, all of that. But there is a giant strategic economic advantage part of this thing, too, which is why the world's two biggest economies, China and the United States, are deep, deep, deep in the 5G race. Marketplace's Scott Tong tells the tale.
If you waltz into a wireless trade show at the LA Convention Center and you say, "Show me 5G," chances are you'll end up playing a video game.
Oh, I see. Oh, they got me again.
In a virtual reality cage, getting blasted in 3D ultra-high def.
Are you going to get out of the way?
Ian Park of Korea Telecom is trying to save me from myself. He explains 5G this way. Today, in 4G, it costs thousands of dollars to play this game.
For now, you need a high-end computer with the two graphic cards. Each one is $1,000.
But a 5G network can process so much data so fast, you'll be able to play untethered with just your phone. Anywhere.
So, your bedroom, living room, bathroom, whatever.
There are, of course, more important uses of 5G. City buildings and lights talking to one another. All the pieces of the power grid connected in real time. And driverless cars. They need sensors to talk to one another and lightning response time to avoid crashing. 5G has it, says Frederick Jadling, executive VP of the telecom giant Ericsson.
If you have a car that is connected and you would like to probably have a pretty fast response time, and 4G can't really do those millisecond response time that are required.
All kinds of companies are at this trade show. Medical, sports and entertainment, drones. They're all betting on the 5G economic spoils, especially in the country that builds the network first. Now, for now, there are limited 5G networks in just a few U.S. cities. The price tag to build that out nationally is $275 billion, estimates the Accenture consultancy.
It's kind of like the race to the moon.
Nokia senior director Elizabeth Rojas Levy describes it like that Field of Dreams movie. Remember the line, "If you build it, they will come"? She says that happened when the U.S. was first to 4G.
We saw this in here in the U.S. with 4G and how it spurred the app economy, the iPhone. Because when you deploy these networks, you start building new applications, new products.
It's no surprise China's in this race to win. The consultancy Deloitte says since 2015, Chinese firms have built some 350,000 5G wireless cell sites. That's more than 10 times the U.S. number. This infrastructure project plays to the strengths of a centralized one-party state, says analyst Paul Triolo at the Eurasia Group.
They've invested tremendously in a sort of whole-of-government effort, if you will. Government, industry, all looking at how do we develop 5G. And China has a huge advantage of scale.
He says Chinese leaders want their companies to develop 5G technology first and create a China-centric hub for innovation. The other leading countries in this race? Japan, Korea, and the U.S. So, what's the American plan? What's the organized vision?
The jury's still out on this.
Priyola says U.S. companies react less to government signals and more to market signals. And the problem is, for wireless carriers that have to invest and build a 5G network, they're not sure exactly who their customers would be and how much they would pay.
Even something like autonomous vehicles, what's the business case there for the carrier? How do they monetize that? So there is still a fair amount of uncertainty among carriers in terms of, you know, not being eager to spend all this money.
Which means despite flashy trade shows and gizmos of tomorrow, it's unclear how fast that tomorrow will come here in the United States. And there's a lot at stake, Triolo says, in what he calls the new U.S.-China technology cold war. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today as we wait for those new China tariffs to hit on Monday morning. 12:01 a.m. Eastern, by the way, is when they go into effect if you're a small business waiting for a shipment to arrive or something. But anyway, you'll recall the last batch of Chinese retaliatory tariffs went hard after American agriculture, soybeans, hogs, a bunch of stuff. And you might remember the White House promised $12 billion in taxpayer assistance to those farmers. Says the Washington Post, today those checks have started to arrive in mailboxes. Almost 40,000 applications for tariff aid have landed at the Ag Department. 7,800 have been approved. All right, we are out of here. The Dow up 86 today, 0.3%. NASDAQ, however, about halfway the other way, down 41 points, 0.5%. S&P 500, we'll call it basically flat. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.